What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
Greetings, colleagues, and welcome to the Defocus Media Podcast. My name is Dr. Daryl Glover, and along with me is my lovely co-host, Dr. Jennifer Lyerly, and today we have a very exciting show in store for you. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Vision Expo.
Where are the best new ideas and innovations in eye care dreamed up? Industry conferences are the best place to meet and be inspired by optometrists, opticians, and eyewear enthusiasts around the world. That's how Daryl Glover and I teamed up to start Defocus Media.
And guess what, Jen? My favorite conference is right around the corner, the Vision Expo West in Las Vegas. It's the place you want to be if you want to learn, network, build relationships in the world of eye care. This year, there are over 320 hours of continuing education, including 20 specialty tracks and courses in the latest and greatest in innovations in our industry.
You know what I love about Vision Expo?
What's that, Jen?
It's that you can just be walking around exploring and you'll come up on a live interview with a famous eyewear designer or a fashion show parading down the middle of the floor or a live pop-up talk with some of the most recognizable faces in eye care.
Absolutely, Jen. And this year, you can even go job hunting at the Vision Expo West. Covalent Careers will have a live booth to help aid one-on-one networking with employers during the conference. How cool is that? Also, Jen, it gets even better. Young ODs like us have access to exclusive events all during the show, kicked off with the Young Professionals Happy Hour hosted by our buddies at Transitions at Lavo on the Strip. The Happy Hour takes place Friday, September 15th from 4:30 to 6 p.m. I hope to see you guys there.
Make sure you join the Young Professionals Club for free benefits, which includes a free exhibit hall registration and 6 hours of free CE. You just head to visionexpo.com/YPC for all the details.
And trust me, you don't want to miss the CE because it's incredible. And you definitely don't want to miss the exhibit hall. There are over 173,000 square feet of exhibit space housing over 5,000 eyewear brands from all across the world. You'll be the first to see all the fall debut lines, accessories, eyewear trends, and more. The Vision Expo is truly where fashion, education, and innovation all come together under one roof.
Be there September 13th through the 16th at the Sands Expo in sunny Las Vegas, Nevada. Just visit visionexpowest.com to register today.
On to today's podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's edition of the Defocus podcast. I'm here with my good friend Daryl Glover. How are you doing today, Daryl?
All is well, Jen. How about yourself?
I'm really excited actually because you know how I feel about cornea disease and specialty contact lenses. So we have a guest here today that I have been reading his articles and following very closely for a long time because he's really a guru in the field. Please welcome to the show Dr. Clark Chang.
Hi everybody. Thank you for the introduction. And it's very nice to meet Dr. Glover and Dr. Lyerly as well. I've been a fan of your podcast.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Chang, we want to hear a little bit about yourself as we're getting started, just in case anyone's not familiar with your work, which would be very hard to believe, but you are the Director of Cornea Specialty Lenses at Wills Eye Hospital and the Director of Clinical Services at Vision Groups Holding. So tell us about how you got into cornea and contact lens.
Sure. And again, thank you. That's very kind. I'm sure plenty of people are waiting to learn about me. I discovered my interest in cornea and contact lenses at the end of my residency at PCO or Salus University. I wanted to change environment and figure out if there is a different population where, you know, from whom I can learn more about different corneal diseases. And I was able to complete a cornea and contact lens fellowship under the mentorship of Dr. Peter Hirsch and Dr. Donald Hirsch. And that it was great because I stepped into the fellowship just right at the beginning when corneal cross-linking was being introduced into United States in forms of clinical trials, multi-center clinical trials. And so being involved in that and seeing patients coming in for consults and being selected through the research process, as well as helping them to rehabilitate their vision afterwards with Dr. Donald Hirsch in terms of utilizing different types of specialty contact lenses that just sort of changed my world and hopefully the world of the patients as well. And I just further fell in love with this area and stayed on after my fellowship to continue with the research work area of keratoconus management, ectasia, and different type of surgical interventions, as well as specialty lens designs and research into them as well. So it was just a really exciting time, and I was in that environment for about 9 years or so when both institutions, Wills Eye as well as TLC, reached out to me and offered me two different type of working opportunities. In terms of, one is a very academic and research oriented, and one obviously is more in the refractive realm. But the interesting thing is that there's a lot of in clinical service department right now within TLC, there's a lot of quality insurance, making sure that research protocols are, you know, rolled out correctly, that patients are being selected correctly, as well as actively, the hope would be at the end of the day, prevent any patients who are not supposed to be treated with refractive surgery who end up being treated. And one of the obviously feared consequences would be developing or creating patients with ectasia. So we're kind of like two ends of the spectrum, where one end, in the whale's eye, I get to actively participate still in cross-linking treatment and research and helping patients see with specially designed contact lenses. On the other hand, at the TLC, where I get to train surgeons and doctors, as well as staff, how to screen patient properly, select the right patient, and in a way, it's actively preventing development of ectasia. So it's a very interesting combination of work that gets me really excited.
So basically, you're the man. Either way, someone's going to see you at some time in their life whenever they have issues like keratoconus or some type of corneal disease, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to lead people into thinking, yes.
Well, you know, we used to think of keratoconus, I know when I was in school even, maybe 1 in 10,000, or, you know, it was just this extremely low percentage number. And then there's been some recent studies that came out that suggest that is really incorrect. I mean, there was a study out of the Netherlands last year that reported 1 in 375 people might have keratoconus or a corneal disorder. Are you seeing numbers that really support that when you're at two different practices?
You know, I am, but I want to say that just with everything, these new papers are awfully interesting. I've been following a lot of different epidemiological studies from all over the world in terms of, because there's a renewed interest to learn about keratoconus, very likely due to the influence of corneal cross-linking, right? So coming back to your question about incidence, because all my patients inevitably have some sort of corneal disease, and predominantly it is keratoconus and corneal ectasia post-refractive surgery due to the nature of the, you know, clinical sites that I'm affiliated with. It feels like every patient that I see basically has either keratoconus or corneal ectasia. So it's hard to even imagine 1 in 375 being the accurate number, because it often feels like it's a lot higher. However, I think that's the beauty of being following an evidence-based type of practice, and that is, you have to learn to isolate your own selection bias, your own feeling, unless it is evidence-driven and it has been proven, in different environment. And therefore, I think I would agree that the instance is definitely not the 1 in 2,000 that many of us conventionally, you know, quote our patients in terms of how rare this condition is. We have to also remember that with the advancement of diagnostic technologies, now being able to look at different layer of cornea and no longer ignoring the contribution of posterior cornea, which now we're slowly learning is really the pathogenesis or where the disease originate, and where, you know, when we're using topography and slit lamp signs, all the different clinical tools that we were taught and given, that although can be very sensitive and accurate when the disease is very severe, and that means the anterior portion of your cornea is affected, we typically rely on that and think that that gives us ability to diagnose all spectrums of keratoconus or ectasia. And that's really not true, because we're only looking at the very surface. And I think so that I think is the one major reason of why the prevalence rate is definitely a lot higher, likely much closer to the 1 in 375 that came from Robert Weiss's group in Netherlands. And I mean, the fact that they looked at 4.4 million of population in their study is something to, you know, be convinced of, that this is definitely a disease that's much more prevalent than we used to think.
So in your current role, you do fit specialty contact lenses, and I know a lot of people listening to the podcast are doing that in their own private practices too. Do you have specific lenses that are go-to lenses in your clinical care?
And that's a really good question as well. Boy, you guys are being really tough today. It's a tough question to answer, only because I feel like my personal feeling is with the advancement of specialty contact lens technologies in the last 5 to 10 years, there's so many good lens designs under each category, be it corneal GP, whether it's intralimbal type of design or even smaller conventional type diameter, to your hybrid, to your scleral, to even soft lenses that can correct for higher order aberration that can be used for keratoconus patients as well. There's so many advancements in each category. It's hard for me to feel like everybody needs to be fit in one type of lens. And obviously with the rise of scleral lens and its diversity and versatility, it's very easy to think that one lens can cover all, pardon the pun. And that, I think it's not quite true, because I can certainly give you cases of where patients have comfort issues with scleral lenses, maybe insertion handling, and just could not live with scleral lenses. And I love scleral lenses. I want to point that out. I have definitely be very heavy in my utilization of scleral lenses in my clinic as well. So I will tell you that most of the time when I'm being asked the question of what's the go-to, what should I, if I only have one lens in my clinic, what should I do, what should I have for my patient? My answer is always, we need to be careful in forcing patient to be fit with one lens, because then we eventually will return to the situation that we had when we only had, say, PMMA or, you know, corneal GP lens. We fit everybody with one lens, regardless of whether or not their condition calls for it or is best suited. And therefore, you're always going to have some patient who cannot tolerate lenses and then be forced to look for surgical intervention when it's a premature solution. So I feel like matching patient profile, looking at their history, looking at what worked before, what didn't work, what's their main complaint, what is their lifestyle, their visual needs, what's their physical attributes, such as their facial profile, do they have any dexterity issue, that type of thing. So I do a very thorough patient interview before I decide what category they're good for. And obviously, the more conditions they have, the more comorbidity that is occurring with the eye. For example, they have maybe keratoconus, but that's doesn't mean that they may not have Sjogren or other autoimmune diseases or even dry eye issues. The more things that they have checked off on my list, the more inclined I am to go towards something that is more complex, such as the scleral lens. So I feel like patient history really drives my lens decision, although I do very heavily utilize scleral lens in my clinic as well.
I agree so much with you. So I also am a scleral contact lens fitter in my practice, but there are many times where I do have to abort, even when ideally that would be the lens visually that I would go with. Some people have an extremely soft or spongy sclera. The lenses just sink and there's nothing I can do to keep them vaulted up. Sometimes, like you said, insertion and handling issues. Fogging is a constant battle with some patients, and despite our best efforts and all these innovations, there are some people that we just can't not get fogging within a few hours of scleral wear. Right. So,
and sometimes every 20 minutes.
right. So we have to be a little bit creative. And because of that, we have to be so familiar with all the possible options and fitting for specialty contact lenses and specialty corneas. So do you have conferences or resources that you recommend, like if a new doctor was looking to get into this?
Absolutely. Let me answer one question that I think I may not have exactly answered in terms of, if we were to think scleral is the lens option for this patient, is there a go-to lens that may be something that other clinicians can kind of follow or focus on? And then we'll answer about the different resources, because I have a few organizations that I'm very passionate about that I think will help a lot of people. So in terms of the go-to lens, I want to say that, again, going back to the very top of this podcast when we talked about following an evidence-driven practice, I am a fan of lenses that has a lot of optometry involvement or clinical science evidence that had gone into it, because a lot of new lenses are following that trend, believe it or not. So I'll give you a few examples. The late Dr. Rob Reese is one of the pioneers in making the scleral lens commercially available. And so he designed that lens. And then that lens was taken over, and Dr. Greg Denayer put a lot of good work in that as well, in terms of evolving the lens into a second generation, along with the use of a corneal scleral topographer to aid the fitting of the lens. So things like that, you know, where they are, like, say, Boston Foundation for Sight had recently released their own commercially available lens, where they looked at thousands and thousands of eyes and looked at different limbal lending angles and incorporated into their lens, and different for right eye versus left eye, where they have data showing that the limbus angle is different between eyes. And therefore they have, you know, in their set, they have few lenses for right eye, few lenses for left eye, all driven by, you know, their retrospective review. There's a lot of lenses like that. Synergize, for example, recently collaborated with actually a company from Netherlands where Dr. Visser, who's a very, very well-known researcher in the area of scleral lenses, where they also looked at many different eyes and studied the limbal angle and how haptic of the scleral lens best interacts with limbus. And so there's that. And one more I want to mention is from the scleral profile study from Pacific University, also inspire many different lenses such as Valley Contacts custom stable lenses with built-in posterior toricity. Also Alden Optical has a new line of lens that works really well, Zen lens that actually is under the influence of Dr. Jason Jelica. So all these sort of optometry inspired lenses have a lot of science behind them. And they are the type of lens that I would say, you know, follow where the evidence is. I would encourage our colleagues to find their, if you need to find one of your favorite lens or one favorite lens to use, try to incorporate one that has definitely a public health component, meaning epidemiology study behind it to show that it does work for a majority of your patient in order to increase your clinical success.
Daryl, what are you fitting for your hair to kind of space?
I like how you just called me out, Jay. You don't fit any special contacts. It's just not my cup of tea. I'm more into high fashion eyewear and dry eyes. That's my cup of tea there. But when it comes to those patients, I typically always refer to my buddy, Dr. Lyerly, as well as Dr. Elizabeth Wickware in the Triangle area in North Carolina. You know, I don't have the equipment, I don't have the time, I don't have the interest, but I can find the right optometrist to refer to in this case. And those are the two people that I typically refer to.
I knew that you were going to say that. I just wanted to see if I was like, maybe you started fitting scleral. I don't know. So I was about to say, like, I love it when you're practicing near where I am because I get the referrals. So it's awesome.
Yeah. And I think as optometrists, that's something we should do more of, you know, not be afraid to actually refer more to other optometrists, because I mean, we should keep the money within the profession, even if we're not all underneath the same umbrella as far as a practice goes.
And I definitely agree, Jen's a good doctor to refer to, so I'm gonna second that. And I also want to agree with Daryl, and you hit the sentiment right on the spot, I think, in terms of we need more if referral between each other within our profession. And I think the most important part for me is that I believe that's the best for our patient care. Not only do you, in areas with lower access to healthcare, where you would have more, ratio-wise, you're going to have more optometrists as primary care eye doctors versus, you know, a wait list for specialists, even though, I mean, obviously their service are very precious and very valuable as well. But then, you know, you get the optometrists who would have more ability to see more patients and then decide, you know, what the management, co-management model would be. I think that often is a better care model for our patients who can get care much sooner. And there's more chair time that typically are given in a full eye exam versus when you go to a, you know, and rightfully so, when you go see a specialist, there's so many patients they're seeing that they're much more problem specific in terms of, okay, if this is one thing that I have to take care of, let's spend 5 minutes on that. So I feel like ultimately a co-management model and referral first to our colleagues within optometry really is the better care model for our patients.
So I know you were going to circle back. You have a lot of resources that you recommend if someone wants to start being the point person in their local community to get all those referrals from other ODs. What are your go-to resources?
Jen, are you sure you want him to share that information? Because then you might not get my referrals anymore. I might have the guide to success here, the blueprint.
You know, Daryl, I think you're going to have to take your own patients in Nigeria. I don't know if they're going to be able to make it to Raleigh easy enough to make that, you know, a place you can refer to.
Well, then let me say one referral resource is Dr. Jennifer Lyerly. Everybody can look her up, of course. Talking about different organizations, though, that may provide, you know, educational resources for both our patients and sometimes even, you know, doctors. So let me name just a few. And I do want to say, while the products that I've mentioned With contact lenses, I personally have no financial involvement or interest in, because I want to just make sure everybody knows that. I just admire the work of our colleagues, and that's the reason I mentioned it or mentioned them. In terms of the organizations, a lot of time these organizations, I am very heavily involved. So I do want to point out my bias in that I love these organizations, partially because I see the benefits for our profession and I give my time to these organizations. So one, International Keratoconus Academy. If anybody's looking for more information on understanding keratoconus and management, and that goes beyond contact lenses. Although we do, the IKA or International Keratoconus Academy does have a new relationship that we're collaborating with the Scleral Lens Educator Society. So very important to be able to understand the disease and know how to surgically manage it, as well as know how, what to do with contact lenses, and specifically in this case, scleral lenses. So those two organizations, they also provide CE opportunities. So I do definitely encourage colleagues to look up if you're looking for something more specific to that area. Another resource that I have is OCCRS, and that stands for Optometric Cornea Cataract and Refractive Society, OCCRS. And that's, so again, goes beyond just keratoconus. It goes into, and you know, corneal diseases such as dry eye, like Daryl had mentioned, surgical management, corneal inlays, presbyopia, you know, LASIK, PRK, and cataract surgery, that type of thing, anything anterior segment. And it's all, these societies are basically all optometrists. The involvement from optometrists in the medical board is very heavy and typically led by or lead by optometrists, our colleagues. So again, I'm naming these organizations because I trust the benefit that these organizations would do for our profession, and the fact that we're of the same mindset, and these are leading researchers and trusted speakers and leaders in our profession. So that's another organization that I think is very important. One more that is specific to contact lenses, GPLI, that's your Gas Permeable Lens Institute, and they're very heavily involved in the Global Specialty Lens Symposium that takes place in January every year in Las Vegas, which will be a very nice place to visit if anybody wants to take a vacation in January to come to Vegas and listen to scientists, optometrists, optometric researchers from around the world, come from 35 different countries. So it's not just the US ODs. There are ODs and MDs coming from different countries sharing their clinical findings and also their contact lens expertise. So those are, I think, very helpful organizations, as well as one more, I haven't broken people's attention span, would be National Keratoconus Foundation. Again, coming back to keratoconus as a disease, this is a very good resource for our patients. They do a lot of good work in providing useful and trusted information to our patients so that they don't get misled by inaccurate information that they may find online. So those are the organizations that I think are very useful for to our profession.
So what about schools? You know, one issue that I had when I was in school, you know, I went to PCO. I remember seeing you there as a senior there. And I just felt like I didn't have the best access to contact lenses. Now, I feel great when it comes to a soft contact lens because I was an optometric technician prior to going to school. And then my rotations were great when it came to soft lenses. But I felt like I just didn't have the knowledge, or I didn't get the exposure to hard lenses or a scleral lens that I wanted to. What can we do in the school system to change that?
You know, that's such a great question. And I think it may not be particular to any one school. A lot of times I think with the curriculum being so medically driven now and trying to cover more disease-oriented information for our doctors in training in these programs, it's very difficult to get a balance. And sometimes you just think that, I think maybe from an educating point of view, they think, oh, you know, you're able to pick up these hands-on experience during your rotation, and maybe there are certain components that get de-emphasized. However, coming back to your great point, and that is, we need to get back there. We need to get back to where we do emphasize all these great tools that we have, whether it, you know, for optical management for our patients, and it could be as simple as even refraction. Because I don't know if you found this, but I also find that some schools may place a little bit more emphasis on training for their refraction, for, you know, how to prescribe to different, to hyperopes, to, because that's a tricky one, as you know, and as well as, you know, contact lens management. So I think one thing that we should do is we need to realize and own the fact that we are the best in optical management for our patients, especially for disease patients when we want to spare them from having to be subjected to surgery when the timing may be a little bit premature. So we need to own that and say, okay, we're the best who can decide if contact lenses or glasses will be able to defer surgical options when they are not quite needed, and be able to infuse that component back into our curriculum. And some schools, I think, do tend to do a little bit better at leading that area, but that's something that many of my organization, for example, IKA, for example, you know, OCCRS, as well as the GPOI, those three organizations that I've talked about, they have very heavy academic involvement in terms of reaching out to residents and make sure they're properly trained before their residency starts. Of course, that doesn't reach everybody, but other organizations that I have mentioned also actually do reach out to school chapters and try to provide access to mentorship, and so that students can take advantage of that. And I'm hoping that eventually that will lead to some influences to the curriculum that we currently have, and be able to add more components like specialty contact lenses back to our education.
I agree. I mean, I did not fit a scleral contact lens anytime in school. I did it the first time on a patient in my personal clinic. And honestly, if I had been there by myself, I'd probably been like, well, I don't know how to do this. I shouldn't do it. But I was there with another doctor who was like, I've never done it either. Let's just try it today. So we, you know, we read the guides and we put a lens on a person. I guess that's why, go back to this, it's practicing medicine, right? You don't have to know it today, but next year you could be really good at it. It's always a continuing learning process. But I think your idea of putting mentors in place for students, for schools, because in a person's practice, to build that sort of following where people come to you for keratoconus fits, the schools have uphill battle creating that name for themselves necessarily, but in the community, there's going to be doctors that maybe students could rotate through, like they could get some hands-on experience.
Absolutely. And I think the most important thing is, like you said, if it's something that you're not familiar with, don't think you're alone, and there are resources you can reach out. And for example, you had another doctor who you could work with, and the both of you working together not only give you confidence and comfort, but there's also another mind in the room, you know, trying to make sure that you're delivering the best quality care to your patient at that time, and that care improve with experience, and but certainly not in isolation. So I think it's very important to know that you have consultants who are well trained, you have other colleagues who are happy to help you, especially within those organizations that I mentioned. So don't go at it alone. Don't do it by yourself, because a lot of times that's a slower way to get over your learning curves. And sometimes it's also slightly dangerous for patients, because we tend to, even surgeons make a lot of mistakes when they're starting to train. I mean, I can't tell you about the, you know, there are times that I look at a, you know, residents doing cataract surgery, even though I obviously am not qualified to do cataract surgery myself. But then, you know, I look at the day one post-op and I'm thinking, I don't know. Like, this is the way medicine is. You're learning by experience, and as you know, initially we emphasize on doing no harm to our patients, but after you hopefully get over that learning curve, we're going beyond doing no harm. We're making sure that we're delivering the best patient care possible, and that really doesn't occur unless you have mentorship at that very beginning of the process. So I would encourage everybody to reach out to these organizations and different resources that can help them.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. I know Jennifer and I, we had the opportunity to work in a group practice where there were several doctors. And prior to us actually having our own office, we had to train with several doctors within that practice. And the one question I always asked was, what was the biggest mistake that you made so I could learn from the mistake? So if there was something that I felt that I was weaker in, I'd pick their mind. And then also if I saw there was something I didn't want to have anything to do with, I knew who I could refer it to, because I knew they were passionate about it, I knew they would get the job done, and I knew I would get my patient back.
Absolutely. And that's, again, goes back to referring to each other, trusting that we will be able to do the best job for our patients, as well as the being able to have patients return to your chair, because ultimately you're the one with the patient-doctor relationship with that patient. So I think that all goes, sort of all feeds into what we've been saying. And I think I see that being better for our profession in the future as well.
So Dr. Chang, what's the big next wave when it comes to corneal specialist practices? as well as specialty contact lenses?
Oh, I think in terms of cornea practice, so two parts, right? Cornea practice, what's next? And for contact lenses, what's next? I think for specialty practices, cornea specialty practices, co-management, yeah, I think that's a big one. So not only, Daryl, you mentioned about more referrals within our profession, because while I may have more experiences in keratoconus, you have more experiences in dry eye management, and someone else would have more experiences in binocular workup, and I certainly would not be able to claim expertise in, you know, binocular workup or prescribing VT treatments, for example. And so I think not only should we remember that some of our colleagues specialize in one group of disease, you know, a few groups of diseases, much more because of just maybe the population they've taken care of, but also importantly, I've alluded to it earlier, specialty surgeons, their services and their care are also very valuable. And when we can get into a better co-management model of understanding what each other can do, we can truly get to the state where we are sort of taking care of our patient via a transdisciplinary type of approach. And that's slightly different than what we have emphasized up to this point, like a multidisciplinary, whereas transdisciplinary would have more input from each other, influence each other's management options. So for example, I may reach out to a surgeon and say, you know, based on what I can do, if surgery is really necessary, because I can do this afterwards, gonna tell you what the outcome would be, whether you do a full thickness transplant or if you do an MDulk, that's more of an anterior lamellar keratoplasty, maybe do it this way because I can do this afterwards, rather than just saying, I'm gonna send you for surgery. Whenever you're done, just send the patient back to me. I'll do my best to take care of the patient. So I think that co-management model would take us into the next stage of collaboration between optometry and ophthalmology to better take care of our patient. And in terms of new contact lenses, a few things that I'm very excited about would be, and number one, I think Jennifer had talked a little bit about some of the things that we're learning about scleral lenses, and its versatility is unmatched by compared to a lot of lenses, but equally we're also learning there are other issues, such as she talked about fogging. She also talked about deposition of debris on the surface, such as wettability issues. So something new that I'm very excited, relatively new, that is being made more and more available now, that we will see sometime later this year, is a coating process that encapsulates your lens that right now only available on specific materials, but it has been shown to really drastically decrease the wetting angle of a high decay material. So something like that I am very excited about and can't wait to try. I currently have few patients who are trying, who have had debris deposit issue, wettability issues that doesn't allow them to get full time wear out of their scleral lenses. So I'm very excited to be trying that, and I know that that's going to be available again later on this year to a lot of our colleagues in specific contact lens material. One more area that I'm very excited about, and I think we've been talking about this for years, would be wearable technology, or a smart lens, if you would. So lenses that they have been looked at to, whether as a measurement of your intraocular pressure when you wear the lens, when the patient has the lens on the eye for 24 hours, is again making our care for glaucoma patients better. They're even looking at lens technology that can measure your glucose level, right? Can monitor glucose level for diabetic patients and things like that. And I think those are maybe even drug delivery to the patient who's wearing the lens. I think that type of wearable technology within the next few years will be something to really be watching out for. And although currently it's being looked at mostly in combination with soft lenses, it is foreseeable that eventually that technology can also be brought into a specialty lens practice.
Yeah, I'm very excited about the wearable technology. I've seen some of the technology that you mentioned, and it blows my mind. And it's just going to change patient care completely, and I can't wait to be able to utilize it in my practice.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, I think it's extremely exciting. And in case just any of the audience is wondering about the encapsulation treatment process that I was talking about that could be available later on this year in specific materials, it's a process called HydroPEG. And again, I have no financial interest with the company. Just in case anybody wants to look it up or inquire with your lab, you consultants, you can certainly do that.
Well, Dr. Chang, thanks for all the great information. I mean, definitely enlightened me today, talking about scleral lenses, keratoconus, and some of this new technology that we're going to experience in the near future. For all the listeners and our followers out there, if they have a question, what's the best way that they can get in contact with you?
Sure. They can certainly reach out to me at Will's Eye Hospital at cchang@willseye.org, and that's cchang@willseye.org. Or they can reach out to me on my Twitter account, and that's at Clark Chang OD.